You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from the Life is Good Ping podcast. Join co-founders of Life is Good, Bert and John Jacobs, as they talk to influential musicians, athletes, business leaders, and everyday people about the role of optimism in their lives. They'll also end each episode with a ping pong charity challenge where the winner gets to donate to their charity of choice. The Life is Good Ping podcast kicks off Thursday, June 13th with the legendary Ringo Starr. Subscribe now on Stitcher, Spotify, or iTunes and add some good vibes to your day. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. As a 60 Minutes correspondent and former anchor of the CBS Evening News, Scott Pelley has been a witness to events that have changed our world. He stood with firefighters at the collapsing World Trade Center on 9/11, advanced with American troops in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, and shared private moments with presidents and would-be presidents he's known for decades. Now Scott Pelley offers a collection of inspiring tales that remind us of the importance of values in uncertain times in a new memoir titled Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. And today, Scott comes on the show to discuss why he was more interested in telling other people's stories than his own, and how those individuals illustrate the best of what it means to be an American. He recalls the heartbreak and exhaustion of reporting on the 9/11 attacks, and why he feels that CBS's 96 hours of continuous 9/11 coverage was the network's finest hour. He shares the story of his first news job as a kid in Lubbock, Texas, the three rules of journalism that he learned from CBS News legend Walter Cronkite, and why he believes 24-hour cable news doesn't undermine network news. It actually makes programs like 60 Minutes and the CBS Evening News all the more essential. He discusses his time as a combat journalist in Iraq and Afghanistan, the question that landed him on Hillary Clinton's blacklist, and why President Donald Trump just can't stop himself from lying. Plus, he elaborates on his accusations that the CBS Evening News was a hostile work environment, explains the secret of 60 Minutes longevity, and shares a few favorite memories of 60 Minutes' lovable curmudgeon, the late Andy Rooney. Coming up with Scott Pelley in just a moment. Scott Pelley is best known for his work on 60 Minutes and as anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News. Pelley's work has been recognized with three DuPont Columbia Awards, three Peabody Awards, the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Journalism, and 37 Emmy Awards, making him the most awarded correspondent in the history of 60 Minutes. Now he's written a new book about his 45-year career in news and some of the people he's encountered along the way. It's titled Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. Scott Pelley, welcome.
Ben, I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you very much.
The title again is Truth Worth Telling. It's hard not to read that as a repudiation of the current administration and society in general's seeming embrace of disinformation, alternative facts, and in some cases, outright conspiracy theories. Is this book a deliberate comment on the current assault on the truth?
Well, I think that it is. I mean, we live in this time, as you've just described, where the truth can be made to seem a lie and a lie can be made to seem the truth. And I wanted to remind people that the truth is a real thing. Solid, verifiable facts are real things. And in the stories that I tell in this book, I try to relate the stories of people who have discovered the meaning of their lives in the historic events of our times and have discovered the truth of who they are in those times.
Given this deluge of social media, online news sites, and 24-hour cable news, do you feel like it's getting harder for a once-a-week, hour-long news magazine like 60 Minutes to break through all that white noise and nonsense?
Well, you know, this has exactly been what concerns me the most about our country. What's the fastest way to destroy a democracy? Is it terrorism, war, another Great Depression? I don't think so. I think the fastest way to destroy a democracy is to poison the information. And that's exactly what we are seeing today as you and I are speaking. Our adversaries around the world, the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, they've all figured this out. Cynical politicians and cynical business people here in the United States have figured this out just to win an election or to make a buck. And I think independent, reliable information is the only way that the American people can exercise the power that the founders gave us over the government. And I'm very worried that we've now moved seamlessly from the information age to the disinformation age. It's a very dangerous moment in history.
And I'm sure that you've probably encountered some people who say, you know, we have 24-hour cable news now. Why do we still need a half-hour network news show at night? As someone who's filled that desk for several years, what's the case for the evening news today?
You know, I've always said that the problem with 24-hour news is that there's not 24 hours of news. And those shows tend to fill hour after hour after hour with talking heads chewing over the same facts over and over again. They'll flash a big banner that says news alert or breaking news, and it'll just be somebody having a news conference. What I liked about the evening news when I was managing editor there was that it was, I mean, to use a highfalutin term, it was a curated half hour of the most important stories of the day. And I would tell audiences, you know, come to us because we will not waste your time. In the 30 minutes on the CBS Evening News, you're going to find the 10 or 12 most important stories of the day, exhaustively researched, well written, with the facts compressed into the things that you really need to know. And in just that 30-minute period, you get a really good survey of the day. And that's where I think the evening news is important. It used to be, as you well know, that a lot of people weren't home at 6:30 or at 5:30 Central Time, for example. But now we're streaming it online all the time. So you can get this curated 30 minutes of the most important stories of the day online anywhere all the time. And I think that's a very compelling argument against filling 24 hours with nonstop blather.
And a lot of great journalists, indeed the greatest journalists of the 20th century, have sat at that same desk that you filled. One of those men was Walter Cronkite, who was a big influence on you. In fact, I read that he taught you the three most important lessons in journalism. Can you tell us what those were?
Well, you know, Walter wanted us to ask very simple questions about everything we wrote, and that is it right? Is it fair? Is it honest? And I try to take that to young journalists and journalism students everywhere I go. You know, we've had this revolution in media, obviously, but I tell people that it's a revolution in distribution. You know, we don't read the newspaper on paper anymore, that sort of thing. We watch the evening news anytime we want to watch it, first thing in the morning if we prefer. But that is a revolution in distribution, not a revolution in content. In my view, the rules of content never change. Is it right? Is it fair? Is it honest? I worry a little bit that people who are involved in what we used to call new media think that all the rules have been thrown out. But that's not the case. Distribution has changed and is changing in ways that we can barely imagine. But the rules of content are the same because the viewer and the reader has the right to have independent, verifiable, unbiased information.
And like Walter Cronkite and another CBS predecessor of yours, Dan Rather, you came from Texas, as did I, by the way, although I wouldn't lump myself in with you guys. What do you think it is about Texas that makes for great journalists?
Ben, I'm sure you found this to be true. I think that America just loves Texans.
Okay.
And you know the new anchor of the evening news who will be starting in the fall, Nora O'Donnell, she's from San Antonio.
Oh, so really? No kidding.
There is something... Bob Schieffer was from Texas,
right,
and
right,
there's just something about Texans and CBS News. I don't know what it is, but these New Yorkers who run CBS News so often just seem to love us Texans.
What was your first experience with a professional news organization in Texas?
Well, you know, my career in search of the truth began with a lie. I was growing up in West Texas in a town called Lubbock, and I really wanted to work at the newspaper there when I was in high school. The problem was they only hired kids who were 16 and above to be copy boys at the paper, and I had a temporal problem. I was 15. So I took care of that problem by lying about my age, and I got the job as a copy boy working the 3 to midnight shift after my day ended in high school. And my co-conspirator, my mom, would drop me at the paper a couple of blocks away from the paper so that I could walk to work so that no one could see I didn't have a driver's license. So I started in this business when I was 15. That newsroom in Lubbock was the most exciting place I had ever seen. All the news in the world came flooding into that newsroom and was distributed as far away as Muleshoe. And I just thought that was the most fantastic thing, and I've been a reporter ever since.
And I read somewhere that you originally wanted to be a photographer instead of a journalist, right?
Well, that was the big turn that happened when I was still in high school. I'm in the wire room. It's like 11 o'clock at night, and I'm working on my high school homework. And the executive editor of the Lubbock Avalanche Journal walks in. He's a big barrel-chested guy with a silver crew cut. If he wasn't in fact a Marine, he could have played a Marine in a movie. His name was Dave Knapp, and he walked up to me one night and said, "Do you want to be a reporter?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I never gave it any thought." And he said, "Well, do you or don't you?" And I said, "Well, sure, I guess." And so he picked me up out of the wire room right then, sat me in front of a typewriter, which I had no idea how to operate. I was 16 years old, and I've been a reporter ever since.
Wow. And that was the beginning of a 45-year career. And I have to say, I enjoyed this book, but it's not the typical self-aggrandizing memoir that we usually find from a journalist who's had such an illustrious career as you have. There is actually, I think, only one chapter in here that's entirely about you. For the most part, you're telling stories about other people. Why did you want to do that?
You know, I wanted to write a memoir, but I didn't want to write a memoir about me. I didn't think anyone would care about that. And my wife agreed with me on that point. And so it occurred to me, though, that I had met the most fascinating people in the world during the historic events of our times, and I really wanted to write about them. So most of the chapters, as you've seen, are titled after virtues such as valor, gallantry, selflessness, authenticity, audacity, that kind of thing. And I talk about the people that I have met during historic moments that personified those values. For example, the first chapter is entitled Gallantry, And it's about the firefighters of the fire department of the city of New York and what I witnessed at Ground Zero on 9/11.
Yeah, you were witness to a lot of that. What was that day like for you?
Well, I ran down to the World Trade Center. I was in Manhattan that morning, and I ran down to the World Trade Center after the first building was hit. We didn't know what had happened. We just knew that there was a tremendous fire in one of the World Trade Center buildings. And I thought, you know, whatever that is, it's going to be a story for 60 Minutes. So I sent a bunch of my people down there and went down there myself. Not long after I arrived, I was looking up at World Trade Center number one. That was the tower that had the big television antenna mast on top of it. And it looked to me, Ben, like the mast was ticking back and forth like a metronome. And I thought, well, that can't be. And I decided it must have been an optical illusion, you know, the heat torturing the light. But as soon as I saw that, the building began to come down. And people have probably, you've probably heard people describe moments of terror or catastrophe as somehow unfolding in slow motion. But I'm here to tell you that it's true, because in my mind's eye, what I saw was the building falling one floor and stopping, and then another and stopping,
wow,
and then another and stopping. Now, of course, Ben, what you saw, what everybody saw, was the building actually rushing down in one movement and with heartbreaking speed. I don't know how I got there, but the next thing I remember is that I'm on my knees in the street, and I'm calling out to God. And I said out loud, "Lord, take them all with no pain." I don't remember getting up. The next thing I remember is being in motion, running as fast as I could with other people around me, with the sound of steel crashing in the street behind me. I don't know how far I ran, but it occurred to me, it dawned on me at some point, that the conflagration behind me was beginning to subside, and so I turned around and walked back into Ground Zero. CBS News was on the air for 96 hours straight, no commercials, no breaks, all day, all night. And, you know, I feel today that everything Edward R. Murrow started for us in the Second World War, everything that led to Walter Cronkite, that led to Dan Rather, had actually led us to this day. And I believe it was our finest hour at CBS News.
And you mentioned a moment ago that CBS did 96 straight hours of news coverage with no commercial breaks of the immediate aftermath of 9/11. You yourself spent days at or near Ground Zero chronicling all of the stories surrounding that tragedy. Was that close to the most exhausted you've ever been?
Well, certainly. And it was the most moving experience I've ever had, the biggest event I ever covered. But Ben, the thing that I've wanted to do for, it's hard to believe, isn't it? But it's almost 20 years now. The thing that I've been wanting to do all these years is try to pay some kind of adequate tribute to what I saw with the firefighters of the FDNY. 343 firefighters were killed in 90 minutes. It's the largest loss of life of any emergency service in the world in a single incident. And I saw those firefighters going up those stairwells, knowing the risk, just against the chance that they might be able to save somebody.
Yeah.
It occurred to me, Ben, as I was writing this, that the firemen did not know who attacked us. They didn't know what 9/11 was about.
Yeah, interesting.
But it didn't matter.
Yeah.
Because they knew what they were about. Some years or even decades before, they had sworn an oath to protect the people of the city of New York, and they had decided then what they would do on this day. It was the greatest act of gallantry ever bestowed upon an American city. I worked on that chapter probably 30% of all the time I spent in the entire book. I worked on that chapter and the research on that chapter, because it means so very much to me.
Right. And I think that this illustrates what you talk about in the book when you say, instead of trying to figure out the meaning of life, try to figure out the meaning of you.
Absolutely. You know, when I was anchoring the evening news, you remember the ISIS attack on Paris that killed 120 people. And we were anchoring the broadcast from Paris after that terrible, terrible Friday the 13th. And I was watching Parisians construct a makeshift memorial on a cobblestone street in the rain one night, and there were children and men and women carrying candles to this makeshift memorial, and they had this look on their face of utter bewilderment, like, you know, what is the mean? If this can happen, what is the meaning of life? And it occurred to me, Ben, that I had seen those people before. I had seen them at the World Trade Center on 9/11. I had seen them in Oklahoma City after the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building, this sense of bewilderment. And it occurred to me, maybe we're asking the wrong question. Don't ask the meaning of life. Life is asking, what's the meaning of you? In other words, when these inexplicable things happen in our lives, how do we react to them? What do we bring to that situation? And that's exactly the organizing principle behind the book, Truth Worth Telling. That's why the chapters are named after virtues, because these are the moments where people discovered the meaning of their life in these historic moments of our time.
Let me ask you this, Scott. Why do you feel the urgency to remind us of these values? Do you think that some of them are in decline right now?
I think, this is my personal view, but I do travel all over the country, and I think that people feel at this moment in time, Ben, a little unbalanced, wondering, particularly after what we hear from this administration, wondering what is true and what is not true, what values matter and don't matter anymore. And what I'm hoping to do with Truth Worth Telling is to remind folks there are great Americans out there of the highest caliber, of the highest principles and values. And those are our heroes. Some of them in the book are famous. A lot of people in the book you've never heard of, but they exemplify the best in all of us.
Yeah.
And so I was hoping to explore what it means today to be an American and what it means to have aspirations for our country's future, perhaps a new American century. And I wanted to remind people of those values that we all hold dear and remind them that a lot of us have those values.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Scott Pelley when we come back in just a moment.
The median annual salary for a cloud computing job is $146,000. Stay up to date and master the tech skills that companies want with a Udacity Nano degree. Udacity's Nano degree programs use the most effective online methods to teach technology subjects from computer programming to the latest in cloud computing. Now get 10% off when you go to udacity.com/kick and use code KICK10. Udacity works directly with industry experts to design programs that include real-world subjects, providing you with true hands-on learning. You'll develop a job-ready portfolio that showcases the right tech skills. Udacity's flexible pay-as-you-learn monthly program lets you learn at your own pace, and they'll work with you to create a custom learning plan that fits your schedule. In addition, you'll get a personal one-on-one technical mentor who can answer your questions and keep you on track. Udacity provides a full suite of career services, including coaching and resume review, to help you land the job you want. Start your future today. Go to udacity.com/kick and use code KICK10 to get 10% off. That's Udacity, udacity.com/kick, code KICK10. Save 10% today.
You follow the chapter on the 9/11 firefighters with a chapter about George W. Bush's handling of the 9/11 attacks. I remember at the time, President Bush was criticized for not immediately returning to Washington on 9/11 and not being in communication with the American people right away. But you say his actions are summed up with one word, resolve. Tell us about the George W. Bush you saw.
We did a one-hour documentary with the president and all the people around him about what happened with the president in the White House on that day. And when I was speaking with the president's pilot, the pilot of Air Force One, he told me that as soon as they took off from Florida, they were headed directly to Washington, but he got a radio communication from the FAA that there was an unidentified aircraft that was not talking to air traffic control, and it was above Air Force One and appeared to be on a collision course. At that point, it was no longer time to get the president home. They wanted to fly him out over the Gulf of Mexico, put fighter jets around him and an 80-mile bubble, security bubble around Air Force One until they could figure out what was going on. Wow. Tillman went so far as to post an armed guard at the cockpit door of Air Force One. The Secret Service went throughout the entire airplane and rechecked everybody's identity, and the flight crew worked on rehearsing their emergency plan in case the aircraft had to be ditched. The president was he was very frustrated by this because he knew that he needed to be speaking to the American people. His staff put together this plan that he would address the nation on the phone from the airplane, and he just wouldn't have it. He ordered Tillman, put this airplane down anywhere you can in 30 minutes. And they did. They landed in Louisiana at an Air Force base there where television news crews had been called beforehand, and the president made another statement, got back on the airplane. Then they decided the safest place for the president would be a secret command bunker outside Omaha,
right,
where a big elaborate facility is built underground in case the president ever has to command a nuclear war from there. The president was briefed on a secure channel by his defense secretary, the director of the CIA, his national security advisor, and all of that. And then the White House staff planned to do a television address to the nation from the bunker. Well, the president wouldn't have that either. He said, no, no, people need to see the president in the White House, not in a jailhouse. And so he ordered them to take him back. I've described that day, 9/11, as the single best day that President George W. Bush had in his administration, because wow, one of the first things that he did in that address to the nation that finally happened from the Oval Office was that he did not allow the nation's ferocity to turn against Islam writ large.
Right.
He made it very clear, this is not a war on Islam.
Yeah.
These people were people who had twisted that religion and that philosophy, and America will not go to war against Islam. I think that was a courageous thing for him to do. On that very day, after we had learned about Al-Qaeda and what all of this was about, that one day, 9/11, I think the president and his instincts served the country well.
And you went on to cover the U.S. response to 9/11, reporting from Iraq and Afghanistan. Is there a particular moment during those wars that really stands out for you?
You know, another chapter, Ben, sums up a person that sums up the war in Afghanistan for me. It was a young Marine, and he was the guy who was at the head of every patrol with the minesweeper. His name was David Hall, and David would sweep the path that the rest of the Marines were following in order to make sure that the rest of his brothers were safe. So we brought a 60 Minutes crew to cover his company in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. And one day while we were with them, David Hall found an improvised explosive device, and unfortunately, it killed him. Mm. But it killed him alone. The rest of his Marines were fine. And I was haunted by that. I wanted to know more about who this young man was. I had learned that at a certain point in Afghanistan, he'd been promoted and they took his minesweeper away from him, and he raised a fuss that they, such a fuss that they had to give him his minesweeper back, and he wanted to be on point. He wanted to be that first guy in the patrol. So I couldn't get this out of my mind, and many years later, I went to Lorain, Ohio, and met with his family to try to understand him better. And what the Halls explained to me was, in middle school, his father told me he was bullied so mercilessly that they had to change schools and put him somewhere else, and that ever since that experience, he wanted to be the person who protected others. He wanted to seek justice for weaker people. And that told me so much about why he demanded getting his minesweeper back, why he always led on point at the front of the patrol, and why he sacrificed his life. It was exactly what he had hoped for. He took that IED by himself. And it's that kind of duty, self-sacrifice, that I saw in Afghanistan and in Iraq over and over and over again. The troops that I saw in 24 trips to Iraq and 10 trips to Afghanistan always did their duty as best as they possibly could.
And now I believe that one of your early mentors was the late Bob Simon, who covered, I want to say, something like 67 wars and other crises for CBS. What did he teach you about being a war correspondent?
You know, Bob was, this goes way back to 1990 and what my wife calls the first Gulf War, when America built this huge coalition army under George H.W. Bush in Saudi Arabia and kicked Saddam out of Kuwait. So Bob and I were sent there. Now, Bob had spent 10 years in Vietnam. He'd covered every gunfight in the Middle East. He was the greatest war correspondent in CBS News history, arguably. I had been at CBS News about 6 months, so I was the kid. And so we're in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, and I admire Bob so much, not just his courage, but his artistry. His scripts were always so brilliantly written. He was really known for his way with words and his ways of description. And one night in our CBS News bureau, Saddam launched a bunch of missiles into Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. They began exploding in the neighborhoods around us. So an air raid warden came into our bureau, which was in a hotel, and said, "Follow me to the bomb shelter." So we all get up and we go to the bomb shelter. Now we're down in the bomb shelter, and I'm looking around. I don't see Bob. Now I'm worried about Bob. Bob's in danger. So I leave the bomb shelter and go looking for Bob, and I find him. He's on the roof of the hotel with a camera crew, lashed up to New York Live, describing what it's like as these warheads explode in the neighborhoods around us.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, that is what a war correspondent does.
Yeah.
And I had seen my first and last bomb shelter. You know, Ben, I think that when America goes to war, all of America has to go. We all have to go. And the way that we all go is through the independent reporting of the combat correspondent on the ground, because that's how we get independent information about what's being asked of our country and our sons and our daughters. I think it's a vital service that we provide to the American people. Mm-hmm. It is extremely hazardous, of course, just like our troops. But it is just that important. And that's what Bob Simon taught me on that night.
There's a chapter in here about the 2016 election, which you say represented the pinnacle of hubris. Not all of these values are positive values. Obviously, President Trump has an exaggerated ego, but do you think Hillary Clinton also got a little too cocky for her own good?
You know, I had known Hillary Clinton since she was First Lady of Arkansas. I covered Bill Clinton's campaign in 1992, and I had known both Clintons for a very long time. I covered the Clinton White House in the latter part of his second term, which was the period in which he was impeached. And then I covered Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, and I covered her run in 2016. when we were doing CBS News polling, and I was anchor of the CBS Evening News, about 68% of the American people told us that they did not think Hillary Clinton was trustworthy. So I asked her about this every interview we did, because it seemed to me that this was something that she needed to hit head on, right? This is what Robert Kennedy called hanging a lantern on your problem. If you've got a, if you've got 68% of the American people think you're not trustworthy, you need to address that every chance you get. But she typically did not. So we sat down 24 hours before the beginning of the Democratic National Convention. She wanted to be on 60 Minutes as kind of a curtain raiser for the convention. And I asked her again about telling the truth to the American people, her credibility. Could she say in the interview that she would never lie to the American people, as Jimmy Carter did in 1976? And her answer began with, "You've done this to me before, Scott." She was referring to when I interviewed her most recently before the Nevada primary, and I asked her the truth question again, and she kind of swung and missed on that question in Nevada. And it really was instructive to me that she said, not, "You've asked me this before, Scott," but, "You've done this to me before, Scott."
Yeah, and I guess she doesn't forgive easily, because apparently at one point she was scheduled to do a 60 Minutes interview, and she had the caveat that the interviewer could be anyone but Scott Pelley, right?
That is correct. And, you know, when she finally answered the question in Miami right before the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, she did a very good job with it. I'm completely unsurprised by that. She is a very intelligent woman who has an intimate understanding of the issues, and she can take care of herself. But it has been a tradition, Ben, for 60 Minutes in every presidential election year. Our first broadcast of that fall is interviews with the two major party candidates. We started this in 1968 with Nixon and Humphrey. So, 2016, a correspondent, Leslie Stahl, is assigned to the Trump campaign, and they're getting ready to do their story. And I was assigned to the Clinton campaign, and the Clinton people called the executive producer of 60 Minutes and said, "We'll do the show, but we won't do it with Scott." And of course, the executive producer of 60 Minutes said, "Well, you don't get to choose. I mean, you can't choose who your interviewer is. You can't choose what questions we ask you. It's, you know, it's please come on the broadcast. But other than that, you don't have any say in what we do. We're an independent news organization."
Right.
And so the Clinton campaign said, "Forget it. We had to tell Trump, never mind. We didn't do the broadcast." And here's the thing that gets me, Ben. If you add the margin that President Trump won by in the three states that gave him the Electoral College, he won by 77,000 votes. All those three states added together, he won by 77,000 votes. And it just seems to me, you know, Hillary Clinton turned down a 60 Minutes broadcast, which would have on average about 13 million viewers, and then went on to lose the election a few weeks later by 77,000 votes.
You've also interviewed President Trump several times, and being in New York, I imagine you probably had a few interactions with him socially even before he entered politics. What are your impressions of the president?
Well, the president is, as we all know, an interesting character, to say the least.
Yeah.
In the interviews that I did with him during the campaign, he just didn't tell the truth. He made things up. And I write about this in the book. In one interview, he said 93 million Americans can't get work, and I'm going to change that very quickly. Well, the workforce of the American people who are of working age, it's about 150 million people or so. So if 93 million people can't get work, then the unemployment rate at that moment would have been 54%. It was 5% as we were sitting there. But it occurred to me that President Trump, then candidate Trump, needed a dystopian America to create outrage that would motivate his people to the polls. And it seems to have worked, but he made up so much of this stuff. The country that he described was not the country we all lived in. The country he described was one in which we had not one friend in the world. Unemployment was 54%, and most of the bridges in the country were about to fall down. And none of those things was true.
Yeah.
But he made the country seem, in those interviews, like it was in desperate shape and needed a white knight, and he was the man.
Well, Scott, you recently made headlines for saying that you were let go as anchor of the CBS News for raising complaints about the newsroom's workplace culture. I have to ask, when you say workplace culture, what exactly were you talking about?
Well, you know, I think your listeners, Ben, have probably read a great deal about all of this over these many months. I mean, we've had we have emerged from a dark period at CBS News and CBS writ large, where both men and women were not respected, were abused, bullying, that kind of thing, and the sexual harassment issues have been very well reported by very responsible reporters. What is great now is that now that all of this has come out, the CBS board took decisive action to root all of this out. We have a new chairman of CBS Corporation, a guy named Joe Iannello, who's a visionary CEO. I've known him for years. We have a new president of the news division, Susan Zirinsky. I'm a little embarrassed to admit to you, Ben, that this is the first woman to run CBS News. You'd think in 2019
right.
It would be about time.
Yeah.
But Susan's been at CBS 40 years. She has CBS News DNA. I've known her 30 years, and I couldn't be more excited about her. And then finally, we have a new executive producer at 60 Minutes in Bill Owens. And Bill and I have literally been in combat together in Iraq. Bill is all over the book Truth Worth Telling because of the remarkable things that he's done in his career. And so I'm more excited about CBS News right now than I think I have been in 30 years.
And you've been on 60 Minutes for, I think, just about 20 years now. And the show itself, I want to say, is going on 52 years. To what do you attribute 60 Minutes' longevity?
You know, my 20 years, you're right about it. Next season is our 52nd season. So my 20 years there is considered a pretty good start.
Yeah.
so many people have been, you know, Mike Wallace, Morley Safer, worked into their 80s. And
right. Rooney into his 90s.
Andy Rooney, absolutely.
Yeah.
What is the secret of 60 Minutes? Well, you know, Don Hewitt, the man who invented 60 Minutes in 1968, no one thought this was a good idea. And I write about how 60 Minutes came into being in the book. Hewitt got turned down again and again and again by the brass at CBS News. He finally got them to put it on the air as an experiment. And it didn't do well in its first two or three or four years. But when it moved to Sunday night, which was kind of an accident almost, it really caught on. It was just the right program at the right time on the right night. And Don used to always tell us, tell me a story. And what he meant by that was you'd walk into Don's office and you'd say, Don, climate change. We got to do a story about climate change. And he would wave you out of the office and say, that's an issue. Tell me a story. And what he meant by that was, find the story about the unforgettable person or the unforgettable event within climate change and use that as the wedge to tell me all about the issue. I tell young journalists that Steven Spielberg didn't make a movie called D-Day. He made a movie called Saving Private Ryan, but in that you learned everything you needed to know about D-Day. He didn't make a movie about the Holocaust. He made a movie that was entitled Schindler's List. But in that narrow little story about one man, you learned everything you needed to know about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. That's what Don meant when he said, tell me a story. And I think that's what we have been doing all of these years. It's a magical concept.
Yeah.
And very simple, very hard to do. And the other thing that has kept us on the air all these years, Ben, is that those stories are handcrafted. I tell young journalists that there's no such thing as good writing. There's only good rewriting. And we rewrite those stories again and again and again, typically something like a dozen times, before the audience ever sees them. I used to say when I was doing the CBS Evening News and 60 Minutes at the same time, I used to tell people that we rewrite the stories at 60 Minutes until they're perfect. At the Evening News, we rewrite the stories until 6:30, because that's the way those deadlines work, and that's the huge difference between those two broadcasts.
Well, real quickly before we go, I just have to ask, what was Andy Rooney like? Was he really the curmudgeon that we saw on TV?
Yes. Yes. What you saw is what you got. I lived near Andy in a small community in Connecticut and would see him in public from time to time and see him socially from time to time. And he was very curmudgeonly that way. But he was honest, and that's what people loved about him on 60 Minutes. I had a guy at the airport today cross the terminal, run up to me and say, "You've got to find another Andy Rooney." And I told him, "There isn't another Andy Rooney." There just isn't. I remember being in a restaurant in this small town in Connecticut, and Andy was dining alone. And a group of people got up from a table and walked over to him to tell him how great he was. And he didn't look up. He just held his palm up, as in, don't. And so they turned and walked away. He was not an unfriendly guy, but he was really honest about the way he was feeling and what he was thinking, and I think that's why America loved him so much.
Can you picture yourself doing 60 Minutes at age 92 like he did?
Gee, I don't think so. I don't think I have that. I don't think I have that kind of gas. But who knows? You know, like I said, the broadcast is going into its 52nd year. We're now, of course, online, and we have our 60 Minutes Overtime website and all these other things that we're branching out into. So it's endlessly fascinating. I'm having a great time.
Well, again, the book is called Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. Scott Pelley, thanks so much for talking with me.
Ben, it's so great to be with you on Kick-Ass News, which is not something I've ever said on the air before. It's been awfully good to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks again to Scott Pelley for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Watch Scott Pelley every Sunday on CBS 60 Minutes and follow him on Twitter at Scott Pelley.
Master the tech skills that companies want and develop a job-ready portfolio with the Udacity Nano Degree. Udacity uses the most effective online teaching methods, and their custom learning plan is designed to fit your busy schedule. In addition, their full suite of career services is there to help you land the job you want. Go to udacity.com/kick and use code KICK10 to get 10% off. That's Udacity, udacity.com/kick, code KICK10.
Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.